Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Unitarian Church on St. Stephen's Green. Welcome if you're here sitting in the pews, if you're joining us live on the webcam, or indeed listening back during the week. It's great that you're here. And thank you for spending this hour with us at our service this morning. A little bit different this morning. It's a favourite readings service, and it's my pleasure to be the compere for the event today. So we have a tradition in this church. Most of you will know that services are often taken by members of the congregation to give the minister a break, if we have a minister, and to hear various different voices from the pulpit. So it falls to me to do that today. My name is Will O'Connell, and I'm a member of the congregation here. I have an easy task today because I don't have to prepare an address. You'll be pleased to know as well. So we've quite a lot of readers to get through today. We'll see how we go for time, but I hope to be able to call on everyone who is here. So we'll have our chalice lighting. We gather here within these walls, hallowed by the community that has gathered here over the centuries. Countless hands have tended the flame of fellowship, and countless more will keep the light burning. As we light the chalice flame today, let us not hide our light under a bushel, but be a beacon of hope to all around. And now we'll have our first hymn. It's number 92, Mysterious Presence. Let us pray. In this new year, may we leave behind the weight of unfulfilled resolutions, of unrealized dreams, and of unrealistic expectations. May we unpack the heavy weight of stories that tell us we are unworthy and unlovable. May we remember that we each carry inside of us a spark of the divine. In this new year, may we carry kindness, gentleness, and hope that hold us through even the darkest days and the most daunting risks. May we carry the weight of memory that reminds us of who we are, and the weight of spirit that reminds us we are still becoming. Let us join together to say the words that Jesus taught us, the prayer that unites Christians of all denominations. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Our first reader this morning is Gráinne.
Good morning, everybody. So I'm going to read from a book that some of you may know of, especially if you're grandparents or parents or teachers like I was. So it's The Velveteen Rabbit, written in 1922 by Marjorie Williams, and I'll just read an extract. There was once a velveteen rabbit, and in the beginning he was really splendid. He was fat and bunchy, as a rabbit should be. His coat was spotted with brown and white, and he had real thread whiskers, and his ears were lined with pink sateen. On Christmas morning, when he sat wedged in the top of the boy's stocking, with a sprig of holly between his paws, the effect was charming. For at least 2 hours, the boy loved him. And then aunts and uncles came to dinner, and there was a great rustling of tissue paper and unwrapping of parcels, and in the excitement of looking at all the new presents, the Velveteen Rabbit was forgotten. For a long time, he lived in the toy cupboard or on the nursery floor, and no one thought much about him. He was naturally shy, and being only made of velveteen, some of the more expensive toys quite snubbed him. The mechanical toys were very superior and looked down upon everyone else. They were full of modern ideas and pretended they were real. Between all the toys, the poor little rabbit was made to feel himself very insignificant and commonplace, and the only person who was kind to him at all was the skin horse. The skin horse had lived longer in the nursery than any of the others. He was so old that his brown coat was bald in patches and showed the seams underneath, and most of the hairs in his tail had been pulled out to string bead necklaces. He was wise, for he had seen a long succession of mechanical toys arrive to boast and swagger and by break their main springs and pass away. And he knew that they were only toys and would never turn into anything else. For nursery magic is very strange and wonderful, and only those made things that are old and wise and experienced, like the skin horse, understand all about it. "What is real?" asked the rabbit one day when they were lying side by side near the nursery fender before Nana came to tidy the room. "Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle?" "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." "Does it hurt?" asked the rabbit. "Sometimes," said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. "When you were real, you don't mind being hurt." "Does it happen all at once, like being wound up, bit by bit?" asked the rabbit. "It doesn't happen all at once," said the skin horse. "You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily, or have sharp edges, or have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off and your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand." "Oh, I suppose you are real," said the rabbit, and then he wished he had not said it, for he thought the skin horse might be sensitive. But the skin horse only smiled. "The boy's uncle made me real," he said. "That was a great many years ago. But once you were real, you can't become unreal again. It lasts for always." The rabbit sighed. He thought it would be a long time before this magic called real happened to him. He longed to become real, to know what it felt like. And yet the idea of growing shabby and losing his eyes and whiskers was rather sad. He wished that he could become it without these uncomfortable things happening to him. One evening, when the boy was going to bed, he couldn't find the china dog that always slept with him. Nana was in a hurry, and it was too much trouble to hunt for china dogs at bedtime, so she simply looked about her, and seeing that the toy cupboard door stood open, she made a swoop. "Here," she said, "take your old bunny. He'll do to sleep with you." And she dragged the rabbit out by one ear and put him into the boy's arms. That night, and for many nights after, the Velveteen Rabbit slept in the boy's bed. At first it was rather uncomfortable, for the boy hugged him very tight, and sometimes he rolled over on him, and sometimes he pushed him so far under the pillow that the rabbit could scarcely breathe. And he missed, too, those long moonlight hours in the nursery when all the house was silent and his talks with the skin horse. But very soon he grew to like it, for the boy used to talk to him and made nice tunnels for him under the bedclothes that he said were like the burrows the real rabbits lived in. And they had splendid games together in whispers when Nana had gone away to her supper and left the nightlight burning on the mantelpiece. And when the boy dropped off to sleep, the rabbit would snuggle down close onto his warm little chin and dream, with the boy's hands clasped close around him all night long. And so time went on, and the little rabbit was very happy. He was so happy that he never noticed how his beautiful velveteen fur was getting shabbier and shabbier, and his tail coming unsewn, and all the pink rubbed off his nose where the boy had kissed him. Spring came, and they had long days in the garden. For wherever the boy went, the rabbit went too. He had rides in the wheelbarrow and picnics on the grass, and lovely fairy huts built for him under the raspberry canes behind the flower border. And once, when the boy was called away suddenly to go out to tea, the rabbit was left out on the lawn until long after dusk, and Nana had to come and look for him with the candle because the boy couldn't go to sleep unless he was there. He was wet through with the dew, and quite earthy from diving into the burrows the boys had made for him in the flower bed. And Nana grumbled as she rubbed him off with the corner of her apron. "Oh, you must have your old bunny," she said. "Fancy all that fuss for a toy." The boy sat up in bed and stretched out his hands. "Give me my bunny," he said. "You mustn't say that. He isn't a toy. He's real." When the little rabbit heard that, he was happy, for he knew that what the skin horse had said was true at last. The nursery magic had happened to him, and he was a toy no longer. He was real. The boy had said it himself. That night, he was almost too happy to sleep, and so much love stirred in his little sawdust heart that it almost burst. And into his boot button eyes that had long ago lost their polish came a look of wisdom and beauty, so that even Nana noticed it next morning when she picked him up and said, "I declare, if that old bunny hasn't got quite a knowing expression."
Thanks very much, Gráinne. Our next reader is Max.
Good morning. My name is Max, and I'm 11, from a Unitarian family, and I am a vegetarian. The reason I'm up here is because my mum brought myself and my sister Poppy on the Unitarian outing to the mosque. It's important to be open, and when all the talking was finished, we were invited to have food with them. I asked one of the men who had done some of the talking in English which dishes were vegetarian, and he pointed them out to me. The food was nice, and at the very end, when people started to leave, my mum was talking to the same man. Apparently, he teaches Arabic. My mum works with language teachers. He said, "You're the kid who asked about the vegetarian food. Are you a vegetarian?" I said I was, and then he asked why. I told him I think it's wrong to eat animals. Then he started laughing, a lot. And then he said, "I'm delighted you're a vegetarian. That means there's more meat for me." What can you say to an adult that's laughing at you? My mum seemed a bit taken aback at his reaction as well. We said goodbye and left. And thank you for the invitation and left. Almost everyone else had left at this stage. My mum tells me it was an unfortunate example of an adult giving a weird response. That doesn't mean every Muslim would have done the same thing. I said I ought to read something about why it's good to be vegetarian in church, so here I am. My family went somewhere between vegetarian and vegan when I was 4. We got 2 pet chickens, and a little while before that, I don't really remember what our garden was. Our first chickens were called Snowball and Maxine. I named Maxine. Chickens are actually quite soft and you can pick them up. Most people think chickens are a bit stupid, but when you get to know them, you realize they're not. At the very beginning, I was a pescatarian, and that was my choice. We went to a turtle sanctuary when we were on holiday. The poor turtles had lost legs, hurt themselves badly because fishermen threw their plastic nets away when they are broken, and turtles got trapped in them. If they are not rescued, they die. I decided I didn't want to be a part of that, so I stopped eating fish. That was my choice. We didn't really discuss it, but I thought about it and I made the decision myself. Let's go back to chickens. Maxine and Snowball were joined by 2 rescue chickens. Rescue chickens are chickens that factory farms get rid of because they temporarily stop laying when they molt. There's an animal rescue place that picks them all up and finds homes for them. Otherwise, they would become pet food. Rescue chickens look terrible at the beginning, but eventually they look healthy. Rescue chickens don't go broody because it's been bred out of them. But Maxine was an Araucana chicken. Araucanas lay blue eggs. And she used to go broody. She'd stay in the nesting box for days, even weeks, because she wanted babies. Some people do cruel things to chickens when they go broody, but we didn't. We let her do her thing. We had Maxine for a long time, and she only died last year. Unfortunately, rescue chickens don't live for years and years, so we've had lots of rescue chickens. We give them a nice life, even if it's short. Maxine was really nice to the other chickens. If one of them was unwell, she would stop finding food in the garden and come over to sit with her, sometimes for hours at a time. She showed empathy. Maxine was very chatty, and she was always chatting away. Not in a loud, frightened voice, but a soft, gentle chatting noise. Chickens are very inquisitive. If you're working in the garden, they are always keen to help. When we let them out in the morning, they charge across the garden to see what's new in the compost heap. And before they go to bed, they come to the kitchen door for a snack before bedtime. We do house swaps, and when people look after the chickens, they frequently comment that the chickens have personalities. We looked after one family's dog. Her name was Luna. And they looked after our chickens. And they said having a pet chicken was almost like having a pet dog, but you don't have to walk a chicken. I think factory chickens must hate being locked up or squashed in with thousands of other chickens. I've been to lots of birthday parties when there's chicken nuggets or sausages on offer, and it's my choice not to have them on my plate. They treat animals really cruelly. And besides, you can get fake chicken nuggets or sausages or even burgers. You don't have to kill an animal. I like good food, and luckily my family are good at making it. My favorite is cannelloni. There are a lot of people in the world, 8 billion. There's not enough space for everyone to eat meat, so I don't.
Thank you very much, Max. I guarantee you not one person here is laughing at you. We all admire you. I wish I could be a bit more like you. I have a feeling there might be an editor of a magazine that might approach you to publish what you just read out. Well done. So we'll now go to our second hymn, and it's hymn number 70. We are a gentle, angry people like Max. Our next reader is Aidan.
Good morning to you all. I'd like to read a short piece from this book. It's written by Jordan Peterson, and it's called 12 Rules for Life, An Anecdote to Chaos. Now, I'm sure many of you have heard of Jordan Peterson. He's a Canadian clinical psychologist, psychotherapist. And I suppose his mission is to address the angst we all face in our times. His work is not only published in books and articles, but also it's extensively available on the internet and on social media. This particular book, 12 Rules for Life, was published about 6 years ago. And I've read it. I think it contains interesting ideas and suggestions. And I also attended an event or a seminar hosted by Jordan Peterson in the O2 a few years ago. And again, I was quite impressed. Now, this morning, I don't really want to read the words of Jordan Peterson, but rather from the foreword, words written by a colleague of his, Norman Doidge, also a clinical psychologist. And his foreword really asks the question, do we need rules? What's the point of rules? Do they repress us? Do they restrict us? Or do they, in a sort of a way, empower us and help us to flourish? So it's a short piece that reflects on that idea, and I hope you find it interesting. Rules, more rules, really, isn't life complicated enough, restricting enough, without abstract rules that don't take our unique individual situations into account? And given that our brains are plastic and all develop differently based on our life experiences, why even expect that a few rules might be helpful at all to us? People don't clamor for rules, even in the Bible, as when Moses came down to the mountain after a long absence, bearing the tablets inscribed with 10 commandments, and finds the children of Israel in revelry. They'd been Pharaoh's slaves and subject to his tyrannical regulations for 400 years. And after that, Moses subjected them to the harsh desert wilderness for another 40 years to purify them of their slavishness. Now free at last, they, the children of Israel, are unbridled and have lost all control as they dance wildly around an idol, a golden calf, displaying all manner of corporeal corruption. Moses, the lawgiver, announces to them, "I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. Which do you want first?" "The good news," the hedonists replied. Moses replied, "Well, I've got them down from 15 commandments down to 10. "Hallelujah," cries the unruly crowd. "And the bad? Adultery is still in." So, rules there will be, but please, not too many. We are ambivalent about rules, even when we know they are good for us. If we are spirited souls, if we have character, rules seem restrictive, an affront to our sense of urgency and our pride in working out our own lives. Why should we be judged according to another's rule? And judged we are. After all, God didn't give Moses the 10 suggestions. He gave them commandments. And if I'm a free agent, my first reaction to a command might be that nobody, not even God, tells me what to do, even if it's good for me. But the story of the golden calf also reminds us that without rules, we quickly become slaves to our passions. And there's nothing freeing about that. And the story suggests something more. Unchaperoned and left to our own untutored judgment, we are quick to aim low and worship qualities that are beneath us. In this case, an artificial animal that brings out our own animal instincts in a completely unregulated way. The old Hebrew story makes it clear how the ancients felt about our prospects for civilized behavior in the absence of rules that seek to elevate our gaze and raise our standards. In conclusion, one neat thing about the Bible story is that it doesn't simply list its rules as lawyers or legislators or administrators might. It embeds them in a dramatic tale that illustrates why we need them, thereby making them easier to understand. Similarly, in this book, Professor Peterson doesn't just propose his 12 rules. He tells stories too, bringing to bear his knowledge in many fields as he illustrates and explains why the best rules do not ultimately restrict us, but instead facilitate our goals and make for fuller, freer lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Aidan. Paul is our next reader. Thanks, Paul.
This book is called Principles of Buddhism. And it's probably the best primer I've read on the subject. and a small extract. Talking about awareness and mindfulness, which we hear about all the time, T.S. Eliot describes it well when he speaks of being distracted from distraction by distraction. The reason for this is that most of us are not one unitary self, but rather we're a loosely affiliated bundle of selves getting by in the same body. Self number one, for example, may decide that she must definitely lose some weight this year after Christmas. So she reads up on the latest diets and invests in a set of bathroom scales. Self number two, however, is having none of that. As soon as she gets the chance, she's off to the refrigerator for another snack. Meanwhile, self number three is wondering whether perhaps a little infidelity isn't what's really called for to make life worth living. But self number four, which really took on board that strong Catholic conditioning, will only let that happen over their dead body, which is probably just as well. What she really needs to make life worth living is to learn to meditate. That way, all these different selves will get acquainted with each other, stop fighting, and start moving in the same direction. Not only are we psychologically fragmented from the Buddhist point of view, we are more often than not nearly asleep, preoccupied with a confused whirl of fleeting sensations and memories, feelings, thoughts, and emotions. We only have a very superficial awareness of the present moment. We're often simply lost in a haze of preoccupation and anxiety, or we're just numbed by the sheer sensory overload that comes from modern living. There are things to do, people to see, deadlines to meet. Very occasionally, we may stop and look. Perhaps we're caught by the beauty of the sunset, and we stop for a moment and pay attention to it. How different are those few moments of quiet, focused attention? A few moments of really being alive. Thank you. And that's from Principles of Buddhism, Kulan Danda. And it's advertised as the only introduction you'll ever need to Buddhism. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Well, let's go to our third hymn, and it's number 163, For the Earth Forever Turning. Thanks, Josh. Our next reader is the man with the golden voice, Dennis. Although Dennis Conway will be very upset. The other Dennis.
My mother wrote poetry, and over the years, some of them were quite good and some weren't so good, but this one I think was published in the Suffolk Poetry Society's magazine. I've always wondered who the person is that my mother refers to in this poem. I don't think it's my father. I think it was before they met, actually, that this was written. Evening in our garden. Never was life so still as now, before the light goes. Between the hour of day and dreaming, the myriad whispers die. No leaf moving, no shivering grass, no wings fluster the delicate air. Even the soft moth, unbuoyant, bowing to one flower cup, dimly awaits the surge of his desire. And you and I in our garden. This alcove of a piece, closed about us like a shawling, has made us bodiless. Love, unfettered by flesh, is absolute. Folded one to another, as mist blends all into one. Still, as the deepest well, lie the innermost jewels of love.
Thanks very much, Dennis. Madeline is our next reader. Thanks, Madeline.
I have two poems from somebody called Dorothy Hunt, who runs a healing and psychotherapy center in California. I came across these by chance, so here we go. The first one is called Tendrils of Mind. No matter how many words arise in your mind, or how many places its musings travel, no matter how many thoughts or opinions it clings to, or how many attachments to how many stories, no matter how many shoots called projections or memories, or how many judgments it imagines are true, there is one single tendril wound round all the others that must be unwound if you want to be free. The last one to drop is the one you most cherish, the one that insists its productions are real, the tendril that causes all of your suffering, the one that holds tightly to a thought called me. Peace is this moment without judgment. Do you think peace requires an end to war? Or tigers eating only vegetables? Does peace require an absence from your boss, your spouse, yourself? Do you think peace will come some other place than here, some other time than now, in some other heart than yours? Peace is this moment without judgment, that is all. This moment in the heart space where everything that is welcome. Peace is this moment without thinking that it should be some other way, that you should feel some other thing, that your life should unfold according to your plans. Peace is this moment without judgment, this moment in the heart space where everything that is welcome.
Thank you very much, Madeline. We will now transition into a period of silence for our own thoughts, reflections, prayers, meditations. And this period of silence will be brought to a close by Shari and Josh playing some music. If you'll forgive me, I'll read a short poem to take us into the period of silence. I'm torn between two as well. I'll go with William Butler Yeats. I was wondering would somebody else choose him today. The Lake Isle of Innisfree. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway, or on the pavement's grey, I hear it in the deep heart's core. Thank you so much, Shari and Josh. Josh, don't go too far and leave your glasses on.
Excuse the Tom Waits vocal mannerisms on this. I'm still struggling to find my voice, which I lost at the beginning of December, but I think it might actually fit in quite well with this reading. So I'm no actor, and there's too many actors in this room, so I won't try the accent, but you have to just imagine me on a horse in the Midwest of America. It's called Jerusalem Tomorrow, and it's by David Olney. Man, you should have seen me way back then. I could tell a tale, I could make it spin. I could tell you black was white, I could tell you day was night. Not only that, I could tell you why. Back then, I could really tell a lie. Well, I'd hire a kid to say that he was lame, and then I'd touch him and I'd make him walk again. I'd pull some magic trick. I'd pretend to heal the sick. I was taking everything they had to give. It wasn't all that bad a way to live. So I'm in this desert town and it's hot as hell, but no one's buying what I got to sell. I make my lame kid walk, I make a dumb guy talk, and I'm preaching up a storm both night and day, but everyone just turns and walks away. I can see that I'm only wasting time, so I head across the road to drink some wine, and this old man comes up to me and he says, "I've seen you on the street. You're pretty good, if I do say so myself, but this guy comes through last month and he was something else. Instead of calling down fire from above, he just gets real quiet and speaks of love. And I'll tell you something funny. He didn't want nobody's money. I'm not exactly sure what this all means, but it's the damnedest thing I swear I've ever seen." Only two more verses. Well, since that time, every town's the same. I don't make a dime. I don't know why I came. I decide I'll go and find him and find out who's behind him. He's got everyone convinced that he's for real. Well, I figure we can make some kind of deal. He offers me a job and I say, "Fine." He says, "I'll get paid off down the line. Well, I guess I'll string along. Don't see how too much could go wrong. As long as he pays my way, I guess I'll follow. We're heading to Jerusalem tomorrow."
Thanks so much, Josh. And our final reader is Janet.
Good morning, everybody. Anybody who knows me will know that I am particularly preoccupied with an affection for our four-legged friends, the dog. So when I came across this book, Dog Songs, by our lovely Mary Oliver, I couldn't resist. And when I came across this particular poem, I really couldn't resist saying it in this setting. The poem is titled, "You Never Know Where a Conversation is Going to Go." It's a conversation between Mary Oliver and her dog, Ricky. So, you never know where a conversation is going to go. Said Ricky to me one day, "Why is it that you don't have a tail?" "Well, I just don't. Maybe once upon a time I had one, but not anymore." "What happened? Did you have an accident?" "No, no. Things change, sometimes over time." "You mean maybe sometimes I won't get a walk? I won't get dinner? I won't get hugs?" "That's scary, plain scary." "No, no, It takes a really long time. In fact, some things change over time and some don't. Well, how will I know what's what? Day by day, Ricky, you find out. Has anything changed that troubles you? Actually, nothing. I like everything a lot, every day. Well, see. Just keep on liking things and praying. Oh, I don't know anything about that. Yes, you do. Every time you wake up and love your life and the world, you're praying, my dear boy. I'm sure of it.
Thank you so much, Janet. We will now have our collection, and Aina is going to play a piece of music for us. Thank you so much, Aina.
Just a quick word to tell you that in the year 2004, on the 29th of December, we had a wedding here in the church. Anne and Mark Traynor married. And they're with us this morning, and they're celebrating their 20th wedding anniversary today. They dropped into us in 2014 as well. And as I happened to be chatting with the people in the seat in front, Margaret and John Leeson, I said, oh, the couple behind you, it's their anniversary today, and it's their wedding anniversary as well. So I don't know if there's an anniversary song, is there, Josh? No? We just give them a round of applause. Congratulations.
So just a few words of thanks, Bridget. Thank you very much for collating the names of the readers, and thank you so much to everyone who read today. It's amazing how it all works out. I thought I didn't have enough, then I had too many, and then it all just works out. Of course it does. Of course it does. When I get out of the way, life usually works out. So to Gráinne, to Max, Aidan, Paul, Dennis, Janet, Madeline and Josh. Thank you for reading our musicians, Shari and Aina and Josh. Thank you so much. Ayla for setting up, and I haven't been able to be at church for quite some time. I've only just seen the Christmas tree, which is quite beautiful. So congratulations to those who did such a beautiful job on the Christmas tree. I didn't wish you all happy Christmas when we started, or to say that I hope everybody had a happy Christmas, and wishing you the best for the new year. Reminded of this phrase, youth is being allowed to stay up late on New Year's Eve. Middle age is being forced to. Just wish you all a happy new year as well. Some notices. The book club. The book club will reconvene in late January on the 29th and will cover two books, Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner and Butter by Asako Yuzuki. And the weekly meditation will resume on January the 8th, Wednesday week at 1:05, led by Pamela McCarthy here in the church. And Pamela will be here next Sunday as well, I believe. Looking forward to that. Thanks, Pamela. And members who wish to have their name included on the Register of Voting Members 2025 should return their registration form by no later than the 31st of December 2024. So you've 2 days to do that. Registration forms were circulated by email to all members on the 14th of November. If anybody needs one, maybe come up and talk to me afterwards and I can put you in touch with our treasurer. But if you've done that before, you still have to do it again every year. So that needs to be done by the 31st if you wish to vote at the AGM. I think that's all the notices. And please join us downstairs for tea and coffee. Fair trade tea and coffee. And I'm so cross. The people brought loads of sweet treats to my house and I forgot to bring them in to give them all to you because I don't want them hanging around my house, biscuits and chocolate. But do come downstairs and maybe some other people remember to bring in some sweet treats as well. And I think that's everything. Yes, thank you to the volunteers doing tea and coffee. Gráinne, Michael, Paula, Daniela, and Catherine for volunteering, welcoming, and flowers. So that is it. We will have our final hymn a little over the time, and it's number 29, Joyful, Joyful. As we come to the end of the service, may you depart from our time together, buoyed by the spirit of life, delighted by the warmth of our gathering, and renewed in soul and mind from the words of inspiration shared today. As we extinguish the flame of our chalice, may its lingering spark be carried in your heart until we are together again. Amen.